And once again, welcome to Behind the Mic, my podcast where I interview a lot of great, great people. And today is no different. One of my, an old friend who I actually met back in the late 70s, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But it's Andy Powell, one of my favorite guitar players from the band Wishbone Ash. Andy, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, Mike. Nice to be talking with you again.
Yes, you're over in Germany right now. Touring, and I'll tell you something, the band Wishbone Ash, such a huge following in Europe ever since the beginning days back in 1970, all the festivals that you guys have played, and I was talking before about when I first met you. It was in the late 70s. And Andy, when did you move to Connecticut?
Well, it was probably the mid 70s, Mike. We had an American manager, American record label, and we were hell bent on trying to kind of crack the American market for the band, you know. So we were touring extensively. So, you know, we came over here and or over there, should I say. I'm in Germany, as you mentioned. But we toured like idiots, you know. So it kind of, in the end, decided to do some recording there and then actually take up residency.
Yeah,
and at the time, people. Sorry.
No. I was going to say, you've been a Connecticut resident ever since.
Yeah, I'm actually a U.S. citizen for my pains as well. I've been in the U.S. for 40-plus years, 50 years, yeah.
But well, what I was saying is that I met you, it was in the late 70s, and you're not going to remember this, but you came into a store I was working at. It was just starting my radio career. It was a store in Westport called Silver of Westport. Really nice luggage and leather goods store.
Remember Silver, and I remember that. I do remember it, believe it or not, yeah.
Because you
was great in those days.
It was, and remember, this is back in the 70s, so yeah, no internet. There was, you know, but I was such a big fan and knew exactly who you were. And when you came in, I said, oh, my God, it's Andy Powell. I can't believe it. My all-time guitar hero. Thank God for my older brother, Freddie, who introduced me to all the great music. And since then, it's like, oh, man, you just made my career, and then you used to come up on my show on Sunday, Psychedelic Sunday. Sunday mornings, you came up a couple of times.
Psychedelic Sunday, I love it.
Where we got to play a whole bunch of Wishbone Ash, and I'm telling you now, that first album, note for note, it's the best first album I think I've ever heard.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say, Mike. I mean, we were kids, you know, but we had an idea and a plan. We had some original music that we were coming up with, and of course, you know, the whole thing with us, and I mean, if you were a band in the early 70s, you were always attempting to try and have an individual sound. I think we created that in the band.
So, oh, there's no doubt about it.
Obviously, as you know, was the twin lead guitar thing, and yeah, I was you know, the first 3 years of the band were a whirlwind for me, you know, they really were.
Yeah, because the touring was extensive. I even got to hang out with Steve Upton a little bit, but that was back in the later 70s. And he was with you for, I think, the first four albums, I believe.
Almost definitely. I mean, Steve and I actually were the last two remaining members in the band quite late on. I mean, late 80s into very, very late 80s, when we formed the original band for 3 years. So, but Steve, yes, Steve and I... He basically was one of the founder members as I was. And, he was there with me in Connecticut for those initial few years, 3 years.
I used to hook up with him down at the Players Tavern in Westport, which was part of Westport Country. And we would sit there and get in these incredible conversations because we're about the same age. He may be a year or so older, but, you know, he coming from England and me being in the States, talking about, you know, 1964 when the Beatles came over here. And it was just great to talk to another person, one of my peers, but from another country. And we both had different sort of views and opinions about music. He was, as I remember, just a great guy to talk with.
Well, yeah, Steve was a reader. He was, he ended up actually moving to France.
I've been told.
When he left the band, he went through some changes. And then he moved to France and ended up managing the chateau there that's owned by our original manager, Miles Copeland. I mean, we have an interesting history and some of the people that we crossed paths with along the way. But, I mean, eventually Steve reacquainted himself, rehooked up with Miles, and ended up moving to France. And he's probably turned half French now, I should think.
Well, you're right, too, because I think Richie Blackmore had a lot to do with getting you guys signed.
Well, that was so strange because Richie became a Reading, Connecticut residence, as I became after I moved from Westport. I went deeper into the backwoods there, and I kind of reacquainted myself with Richie just by accident. It turned out that he was running a football team. He's an English soccer fan, a player himself. So his kind of crew were living up there in the woods, and had a football team, or soccer team, as we say in America. But anyway, Richie had a very instrumental role to play in the signing of Wishbone Ash to Decca MCA, as it was back in the early 70s, because one of the very first shows we ever did in the UK was opening for Richie and Deep Purple. And the story went that he was sound checking, and I had my gear set up as the opening act behind him, and he was sound checking on his guitar. And I sort of cheekily went to the back of the stage, plugged my guitar, and he played a lick, and I play a lick. And then we ended up in this kind of guitar duel, you know. Richie was never the most approachable guy, but he actually got a kick out of it, I think. And afterwards, he came to me and said, and he watched the band by that point, he watched our opening set, and he said, yeah, I really like what you're doing. He said, have you guys got a recording contract? I said, no, but we'd really like one. He said, I think I might be able to put a word in for you with someone I know. Long story cut short, the person he knew was the CEO of MCA out in LA, actually. So we ended up having an American manager, and we signed directly to a US label. Unlike a lot of London bands or British bands that signed to a subsidiary often of a US label that might have been in London, you know, like whether it be CBS or Warner's or whatever it was. And so that was another part of the American connection. Long story. I mean, I actually went up there to watch him play, and I introduced myself and I said, Richie, I just have to thank you because, you know, I owe a big part of my life to that meeting and that jam session that you and I did, because we did sign with MCA. We had a lot of success. And so I just had that opportunity to actually thank him. So it was cool.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a little cheeky of you, wasn't it? Because everybody knows
it
Richie Blackmore.
I was younger. He was older, you know, an older, more mature musician.
Yeah.
And I was just coming onto the scene, you know.
That is so cool, man. I'm telling you. And he must have been impressed because, you know, you're just an incredible guitar player. Hey, and famously for the Flying V, of course. It's always been your signature guitar.
Well, there's a whole story behind that too, but I don't know how much time you got. But
anytime, as much as you want, my friend.
Well, yeah, the guitar became by default something that I've been identified with for years, and the story of that, basically, at that point, the Flying V was not really an iconic rock guitar like it is now. I mean, now if you're a guitar player, you know. There's probably three iconic guitars. There's the Fender Stratocaster, the Gibson Les Paul, and for rock and metal, the V. Well, you know, they weren't selling from Gibson, and there were two of them in a London store, and they've been they were already 5 years old, 1967 models, you know. And I went in there to buy some equipment, and I saw this guitar. I said, oh, well, let me try this amp with a guitar. I'll take that Flying V up there. Plugged it in, and I went, well, the amp sounds good, but this guitar, even before I plugged it in, I said, well, this is really cool. This is exactly the kind of sound I've been looking for, even before it was plugged in. Anyway, ended up buying the amp and the guitar. I think the guitar cost me $300 or something. And that's how much. Everything was $300 in those days. And the thing was, it was brand new in the packing case, and there were just two of them in London at that time. And I bought this one, and then I took it home back to my little bed set flat, we used to call them in London. And I sat down, and I put it on the end of on a chair, and I just, I couldn't believe I had this thing. It was like something exotic, weird thing from another planet. And then, of course, you know, I was a skinny guy. You know, when I was like 22 or something, I weighed about 140 pounds or something. I used to wrap myself around that guitar. It was a, you know, there's no way with a Flying V you can sit down.
Okay? Right. It's a performance guitar. It slides off your lap every time.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I'd swing it around my neck, and pretty soon, you know, I started taking it all over the world with me. I had a special case where I didn't have a case. And I'll never forget, one time I was traveling through the South, and we would fly everywhere in those days. We'd rush to airports, jump on a plane. There's never any security or anything like there is now. And I remember I had this in a shaped case, exactly like the guitar. And this huge guy at the gate, one of the airline staff, he said, "Hey, buddy, well, what you carrying? It looks like a snake catcher." And because he said, "What kind of snakes are you going to catch with that thing?" You know, people hadn't seen anything like that. Of course, the case, it was like a violin case was formed to the shape of the guitar. So I would go through these airports with this thing, and people would look at me like I was from another planet. It was hilarious, really.
You know, a lot of the older blues guys played the Flying V. Which kind of cool.
I mean, it wasn't in rock per se at that time, but
right.
Certainly I was aware of Albert King as well. I think that's who you're thinking of.
Exactly.
I mean, Albert, I'd seen his photo on a single sleeve, you know, and I clocked, you know, I knew the guitar, but I didn't know it, if you know what I mean. Mm. It wasn't mainstream, and I mean, we were all this, you know, I'm talking about the late 60s. I mean, the kind of people we were listening to were, you know, blues players from England, really. There were three of them that were really big. I mean, obviously, it was Beck, who sadly just passed away,
right.
And it was Clapton was a huge influence on me, and then Peter Green was probably the biggest influence. And these were all kind of Les Paul players. Well, you know, I ended up I was only about 15 then, so I couldn't ever afford such an incredible instrument as a Les Paul. So I ended up making one at home. My dad was a bit of an engineer, and I used to like tinkering, and I made one, and we called it the Les Powell. But it was just a fun thing. But I ended up making a couple of guitars, and one of them I used in the first year with Wishbone Ash. And then, so I knew a lot about making guitars. I discovered all that by actually producing one myself. So when I got the chance to buy this beautiful thing made in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you know, and I realized it was a very cool guitar. And it became, you know, it was very photogenic, and it became something that I was always getting my photo in the British press as a result of the look of the guitar, partially in the way I played it and handled it. And so it became iconic, and it became something that I couldn't have escaped from it even if I wished to. So I've had numerous of them since, but I still have that original 1967 V, which has appeared on many of the albums, all of them, in fact, I would say.
I want to talk about the albums in just a moment, but talking about you and the guitar, being the guitar player that you are, you guys really sort of kind of kicked off the Twin Lee guitar sound. Four-piece bands was drums, bass, rhythm, and lead, but you guys had drums, bass, and then two lead guitars, you and Ted, in the beginning, trading off licks, which is what turned me onto the band right there, because it was such an incredible sound.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said earlier, all bands in the late 60s, early 70s were looking to push the envelope even further. I mean, if you think about it, the 60s, so much had been done in the 60s. And, you know, we'd moved very rapidly from bands like the Kinks and the Who, and then through the British blues boom with the guitarist I just mentioned, and all the work was done by bands, people with Rod Stewart and the Faces and, you know, these rock bands. And then the 70s came by, and you had to have a signature sound. And, of course, people call it progressive rock now, but we were just experimenting with a bit of jazz, a bit of blues, some crazy time signatures. And so we were pushing the envelope and trying to learn as musicians, really. That was all there was to it.
Oh, yeah.
I
was going to say that the first album came out in 1970, and it's like you were just talking about the heavy-duty touring that went on. What about being in the studio? You had an album came out in 1970, the first one, then 71 Pilgrim Ridge, 72 Argus, 73 Wishbone 4, celebrating its 50th anniversary. It's like every year you guys came out with an album, and that takes time along with the touring, so it must have been a really busy time for you guys in the beginning.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, once the record labels cottoned onto the Shins and bands, coupled with FM as a radio guy, you know, it played such an important role in breaking bands. The management and the labels, they were rocking. I mean, they were doing incredible business. So they worked us intensely. So we didn't know anything different. I mean, that's where I actually get my work ethic from even today. I mean, before that, as a teen, I was always in bands and playing every weekend. And I always kind of was a hard-working person. But when the 70s came along, I mean, we literally didn't stop. If we weren't touring, we were recording. And the record label, it was all And how we ever produce so much material in such a short time, I don't know. I mean, with a lot of bands, you know, it's usually the third album that hits big. And it was the same for us with that Argus album you just mentioned.
Right.
I mean, we started out, well, the first couple of albums were really more of our sort of club set. And we'd just go in the studio and record the songs that we'd written, that we played on the road when we were touring the clubs.
And the first album, the first album was a lot of jamming. I mean, the songs, there were no short songs on that first album.
You're so right. Yeah,
and at the time, that's what FM radio was playing. And we were playing those 6, 7, 8 minutes in Phoenix, 10 minutes, you know, on the air, which was awesome. And then come Argus,
they would call that deep cuts now, right?
Or classic cuts? I don't know.
Yeah, the thing is that it was really when we started touring America and playing the big rooms. I mean, the first tour that we got on was with the Who, actually. And the first show, I'll never forget it, we played Mississippi River Festival, 35,000 people. And my mind was forever blown because I hadn't played on a stage so big. And I realized very quickly that we needed more grandiose music and we needed more composed music. And I'd say, I guess what you refer to the first two albums, we would have almost been like a jam band now, really. I mean, that's how we were. We were eclectic. We were playing fast and frenetically. But when we started playing those big stadiums, we realized that we needed more thematic music, more grandiose themes. And that's what gave birth to the Argus album, which, if you think about it, especially the second side of that album, it's very definitely a precursor to stadium rock. You know, big songs, big themes lyrically, and you know, these same extended guitar solos, but all within the framework of compositional pieces.
So the highlight to me,
when it all really changed.
The highlight to me on Argus, of course, is "Blowing Free." I mean, to me, one of my favorite songs of all time. It's just the perfect song.
You know what it is for me? That song, I know you probably agree with this in a way, if you like it, but it kind of sums up the 70s. You know, if you were a young person and you were free and easy and everything, the world was opening up to you, that's how it was when we came to America in 1970, because, you know, it was just wide open spaces. Everything was possible. Total can-do culture. Yeah, it still is pretty much, but it's changed, you know. And in those days, and of course, you know, we were the baby boomers. We came along post-war with money, ideas, representation, and the world was our oyster. We were able to realize these incredible ideas, you know, as musicians.
Those are really good times, because Argus came out the same year I graduated high school, 1972. Just a huge fan, and then, you know, a few years later, actually meeting you in Westport was definitely a highlight in my life, for sure. And it was so good to see you last spring. But let's talk about the show coming up on Wall Street Theater, which, by the way, it's a great venue, man. I just love that venue. It's intimate, it's nice, and every seat's a good seat. You're going to be there Friday, February 24th, and I'm definitely going to be down there, of course, to see you and play Eric.
That looks great. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, they look after the band down there. They look after the audience as well. And as you say, there's not a bad seat in the house.
There really isn't. It's a fun venue, and I can't wait to see you now. Over 25 albums released. You had 12 live albums. Is there a box set coming out soon that I understand, or a compilation?
Well, we did have a set, a very large box set, which is really a career retrospective. That was called The Vintage Years.
Right.
And that was all 70s albums, repackaged, done in a beautiful box. It's a real collector's item. They only produced, I think, 2,500, and that was it. Worldwide. And this company that we work with on these box sets and these retrospectives is called Snapper Music in the UK. They do, they're world renowned. They're absolutely brilliant at this stuff, because they're able to get with those old labels and license the material and the live recordings, and they work with, I mean, a lot of the artists, you know, it's difficult to talk with them, or they don't talk with each other, and they are masters at doing this. So, but you're right, there is another one coming out, which is, in fact, in point of fact, to celebrate 50-year anniversary of the release of Argus. So we're a little bit late now, about 51 years, but this is a package that will be, it's not quite as grandiose a package because it's only one album, but there's some live albums going around with it, some vinyl, a beautiful kind of coffee table book with a lot of interviews with at least three of the original members in the band, and, you know, remembrances, memories from the from that era. And some photo, most importantly, I mean, back in those days, you and I both know there were some incredible peripheral stars around the band, like yourself. But there were always photographers. You know, we have amazing photographers in those days. And some of the renowned ones, you know, we've actually managed to get photography that has never seen the light of day before. So it's a beautiful package, especially for a collector or somebody that wants to recognize or remember that era and that time and for the band. So the Argus album, it's much more than just the album. It's a retrospective, a kind of career overview at that time with vinyl and some live recordings and the coffee table and all the rest of it. So that's a really nice thing. That's coming out, I think, it's on release tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what I was reading. JD sent me something over. I guess he's your manager or...
JD is somebody, a local person who runs a PR company, and he's working with us right now, promoting
nice.
And...
Yeah, nice guy, great working with him, too. He set this all up, which is nice, and I was going to see you anyhow come February, but it's great to talk to you and put you on my new podcast called Behind the Mic. To have you on as my guest is absolutely a treat for me, that's for sure.
Well, it's my pleasure, too, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a hard guy to get a hold of as well with all the traveling, you know.
Yeah, well, you know what, you know, but the thing about it, now I got Pauline's phone number, so I know I can call you anytime.
You can, yeah.
I would never.
Pauline, my wife, yeah. But she's the de facto manager now of the band. She actually taught for many school in Connecticut and so on in New York for many years. But she travels with me, and she also, like, this happens in a lot of bands. She actually does a lot of the managing from the home base in Connecticut and also travels with me quite a bit. But I mean, this year, Mike, we are touring like never before. I mean, it's quite incredible, really. I mean, I am addicted to travel. I like the touring life. I like the life of a musician. But this year in particular, because we're hitting so many, well, we had the COVID scenario, right? None of us musicians could really work. So we're making up for lost time there. We're also just celebrating a lot of anniversaries, really. We did the 50th anniversary of the band. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Argus album and so on and so forth. So it needs a lot of management, and it needs a lot of people on the periphery like JD to help us with what we do.
Well, I can't urge everyone out there to go see you guys. If you're new to Wishbone Ash, start off with that first album. When I first heard it from beginning to end, I still listen to it all the time. It never, ever, ever gets old to me. I can play air guitar perfectly to every single song on that album. That's how good I am on the guitar, air guitar, that that is. But I can't urge you enough to go out, see you guys. Wall Street Theater, not only a great venue in Norwalk, but also an incredible band, Friday, February the 24th. I'll see you then. When are you coming back to the States, by the way? When is this the Europe thing in for you?
This German tour, which is going great, by the way, that, I think, finishes in a couple of weeks. So I'll come back for about a week or 10 days, make preparations, and we start with that U.S. tour. And, we'll go up and down the East Coast and even out to the Midwest a little bit. So, and then we do a separate U.S. tour later in the year, and then we take in the South and, Texas, and
right.
We move across the country, and we get out to the West Coast.
Yeah.
So it's impossible to do a tour of the whole country in one go, as you know.
I'll tell you, Andy, it's good to have you guys on the road. Again, one of my favorite bands growing up. One of my favorite bands today is Wishbone Ash, Wall Street Theater, Friday, February 24th. Andy, thanks for being a part of the interview today on Behind the Mic.
Mike, an absolute pleasure talking to you. Take care. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.